Call Me Ishmael. Anyone know what novel that begins? Very good. Very good. Somebody paid attention in freshman year English class. So Moby Dick. So what is the story of Moby Dick about? A whale. Interestingly, this novel really isn't about a white whale. It's about Captain Ahab and his thirst for revenge is really what Moby Dick is about. Sometimes the character name in the title isn't the main focus of the story. And we're facing something similar today as we continue to journey through the stories of some faith heroes from the Bible. Today we're going to take a look at the story of Ruth. And as you're about to discover, the story of Ruth is every bit as much, if not more, about another character in this story. And as you look at stories, in addition to the main character of the story, it's always good to identify the main lesson. What is the theme? What is the takeaway? What are we supposed to learn from reading this? How should I act differently? And that's never more true than when you're looking at stories in the Bible. Every time we read a biblical story, we need to be asking ourselves, how should I live differently on the other side of this? Because the aim of the Bible is to help us walk the path that God has shown us, to become the people that he designed us to be. And in the case of Ruth, here's what I would suggest as the main lesson from the book of Ruth. And that is this: the life of God followers is not a straight line to glory, but they do get there. Okay? The life of those who are following Jesus, or following after God, it's not always a straight line to glory, but they do get there. It's, in other words, it's not an interstate highway through the Midwest. You know, if any of you guys have ever driven an interstate across the country, you know that there are miles and miles, hundreds of miles, where it's just, and you just go. And the landscape doesn't change much. You know, think West Texas. You know, that's a fun drive, isn't it? And it's just, you know, it doesn't change a whole lot. But instead, this life of faith is more of a county road through the Blue Ridge Mountains of Tennessee. Okay, it's a whole different experience. There are rock slides and dangerous drop-offs and dark mists and bears and slippery curves and hairpin turns that make you go backwards in order to eventually go forwards. But all along this faith road, this hazardous twisting road that doesn't let you see very far ahead, there are frequent billboards in our life of faith that say the best is yet to come. There are billboards all along our faith journey that tell us the best is yet to come. And at the bottom right corner of every one of those, written with an unmistakable hand, are the words, "I've got you, God." He's got you, he is with you, and he is going to see you through. We've got signs all throughout our lives that point to the goodness of God, to his protection, to his favor, to his blessing. And if we're going to navigate the constant chaos of this life, we've got to know that God is leading us into a future that we can say with certainty, the best is yet to come. I know that the best is yet to come in my life. I know that no matter what this life holds, the best is yet to come. And the book of Ruth is one of those billboard signs for us to read. It was written to give you encouragement and hope that all of the crazy turns in your life lately are not dead-end streets. It doesn't end there. In all of the setbacks of your life, as a follower of Jesus, you've got to know this: God is planning and designing everything for your ultimate joy. As a follower of Jesus, God is planning and designing everything for your ultimate joy. Now, the story of Ruth is a series of setbacks. One after another, as you read through the book of Ruth, it is a series of setbacks, one bad life circumstance after another. And so I want to walk you through this morning some of this story to give you a little bit of background. It begins with a woman named Naomi. Naomi is the first character we're introduced to. She, her husband, and her two sons live in Judah, where there is a terrible famine that has lasted for years. And the famine is so bad that for their family to survive, they have to leave. And so they pack up everything and they move to Moab, which is a distant land, a foreign land to them. And there, once they got there, her husband dies. So now it's just Naomi and her two sons. And the sons marry Moabite women. They take foreign wives where they've moved and resettled. And for 10 years, neither one of her sons are able to have children. Their wives are barren. And then to top it all off, after those 10 years of no grandkids, no one to continue the family line, both of her sons die, leaving Naomi and her two widowed daughters-in-law in the household. Naomi returns to Judah, where the famine has ended now, and she tells both of her daughters-in-law to stay in Moab with their people. And one of them says, okay, but Ruth would not hear of it. She was committed to Naomi. And in Ruth 1:16, we read this. But Ruth replied, "Don't ask me to leave you and turn back. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God." An incredible statement of support of Ruth for Naomi. And even with Ruth's famous declaration of support, chapter 1 ends with Naomi's bitter complaint. "I went away full, and the Lord has brought me home empty. The Almighty has sent tragedy upon me." She is bitter. She is broken. She has nothing. And then comes chapter 2. And Naomi is now filled with new hope, because we're introduced to a man named Boaz, who appears on the scene as a possible husband for Ruth. So he introduces them, and this is hugely important because really there is no way in this culture in which they are living right now for a woman to generate income. A woman cannot produce income, and they would starve without a man in their lives to provide for them. So Boaz was a huge potential answer to prayer for them. But he doesn't propose to Ruth. He doesn't make any moves. At least that's the way it seems at first. So the chapter here, chapter 2, closes with this possibility and excitement and hope that things could change, but also with some suspense and uncertainty about how this all might work out. It kind of sounds like some of our lives and what we go through. We have excitement about the possibilities of the future, but at the same time, uncertainty and even stress about the future and how we're going to get there. How are we going to navigate the road in front of us? What is it going to look like? Will we even be able to get there? There's all this stuff that we are faced with all the time. In chapter 3 now, Naomi and Ruth make a bold and risky move in the middle of the night. So Naomi coaches Ruth and says, "Here's what I want you to do." And so Ruth goes to Boaz, this guy, while he's threshing grain on the threshing floor, and says to him, in effect, "I want you to spread your wing over me as my husband." In other words, "I want you to marry me and be my protector and provider." That wasn't really done, but she did it anyway. But right when the tragedy of Ruth's past seems to be resolved into this beautiful love story, a big Blue Ridge boulder rolls out onto the county road of Ruth's life and threatens to smash it. There is another man who, according to Hebrew custom, has prior claim to marry Ruth. They had a process in place for a kinsman, for a relative, when a husband died, to redeem his property and redeem his wife and his children by marrying her. There was a process that was in place for this. And so the impeccably honest Boaz will not move forward without giving this man, the man who has the rightful claim, his lawful opportunity. So chapter 3 ends, again, in the suspense of another setback from what we see as this amazing resolution that is right there. And so Ruth chapter 4 is where we're going to focus today. And I'm going to read verses 1 through 17 of Ruth 4 so we can get kind of the full conclusion to this story. This is how it reads. "Boaz went to the town gate and took a seat there. Just then the family redeemer he had mentioned came by, so Boaz called out to him, 'Come over here and sit down, friend. I want to talk to you.' So they sat down together. Then Boaz called 10 leaders from the town and asked them to sit as witnesses. And Boaz said to the family redeemer, 'You know Naomi, who came back from Moab. She is selling the land that belonged to our relative Elimelech,'" that was her husband, "'I thought I should speak to you about it so that you can redeem it if you wish. If you want the land, then buy it here in the presence of these witnesses. But if you don't want it, let me know right away, because I am next in line to redeem it after you.' The man replied, 'All right, I'll redeem it.' Then Boaz told him, 'Of course, your purchase of the land from Naomi also requires that you marry Ruth, the Moabite widow. That way she can have children who will carry on her husband's name and keep the land in the family. Well, then I can't redeem it, the family redeemer replied, because this might endanger my own estate. You redeem the land, I cannot do it. Now, in those days, it was the custom in Israel for anyone transferring a right of purchase to remove his sandal and hand it to the other party. I'm so glad that is not the current custom anymore. This publicly validated the transaction. So the other family redeemer drew off his sandal as he said to Boaz, "You buy the land." Then Boaz said to the elders and the crowd standing around, "You are witnesses that today I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. And with the land I have acquired Ruth, the Moabite widow of Mahlon, to be my wife. This way she can have a son to carry on the family name of her dead husband and to inherit the family property here in his hometown. You are all witnesses today." Then the elders and all the people standing in the gate replied, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make this woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, from whom all the nation of Israel descended. May you prosper in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. And may the Lord give your descendants by this young woman who will be like those of our ancestor Perez, the son of Tamar and Judah." So Boaz took Ruth into his home, and she became his wife. When he slept with her, the Lord enabled her to become pregnant, and she gave birth to a son. Then the women of the town said to Naomi, "Praise the Lord who has now provided a redeemer for your family. May this child be famous in Israel. May he restore your youth and care for you in your old age, for he is the son of your daughter-in-law who loves you and has been better to you than seven sons." Naomi took the baby and cuddled him to her breast, and she cared for him as if he were her own. The neighbor women said, "Now at last Naomi has a son again," and they named him Obed. He became the father of Jesse and the grandfather of David. Now, what I want you to see from this story, because this story goes all over the place and keeps changing directions on us, and that is this: the road we're traveling on has one curve after another. Just when you think you've got life figured out, just when you think you know what's going to happen next and what the next 10 years are going to look like, everything changes again. And it doesn't matter if you're in vocational ministry. It doesn't matter if you're working a full-time job, if you're a homeschool mom, if you're a high school student, if you're in college. I'm telling you, there is one curve after another that comes at you throughout life. And the only thing that is constant in life is inconsistency. It's going to change. And after the midnight rendezvous in chapter 3, Boaz goes to the city gate here where the official business is done. The closer relative comes up, and Boaz lays the situation out. Naomi's giving up what little property she has, and the duty of the closer relative is to buy it so that the inheritance stays in the family. That's why he did this. And when you've read the entire story, it's a little disappointing when the guy at the end of verse 4 says, "I will redeem it." And you're kind of like, no, you're not supposed to do that. We want Boaz. He's the better choice here. He really cares for her. He's gone out of his way to help her in chapter 2. We want Boaz, and we don't want this other dude to redeem it. We want Boaz. So again, there seems to be a setback. And the irony of this setback is that it's being caused by righteousness. Okay? This guy is not malevolent. He's not trying to mess things up. He's not trying to ruin her life. This dude is only doing his duty to his family. This is what Hebrew culture says he's supposed to do. And here's what you need to understand from this. Sometimes that Blue Ridge Highway that we were talking about is all clogged up. Not with boulders, not with bears, but with good workmen doing their duty. They're fixing the road. And it's messing everything up. And sometimes in life, our frustrations are not only caused by sin, but also by righteousness with bad timing. Sometimes we get frustrated not by sin, but by people doing good things that just messed us up. How many times in your life have you been blindsided by someone who had the best intentions? Like, really, they weren't out to get at you. They weren't out to mess you up. They weren't out to sideline you, but they did. But they had your best intentions. Maybe they didn't have all the facts. Maybe they were confused. Maybe they were just clueless. But their well-intentioned actions didn't do you any favors at all. It's not only sin that can mess us up, but good deeds with poor timing or without wisdom can mess us up just as badly. And when we're about to say, "Oh no, stop the story, don't let this other guy take Ruth," Boaz says to him, "You know, don't you, that Naomi has a daughter-in-law and she's part of the package. You buy the land, you get this woman as your wife as well and raise kids in the name of her husband, Mahlon." And finally, to our great relief, the guy says in verse 6 he can't do it. Maybe he's married already. Maybe he's got children of his own and he doesn't want to mess up their inheritance. He doesn't tell us why, but whatever the reason, we're cheering in the background as Boaz gets through the bottleneck on the Blue Ridge and fast tracks it to the wedding feast with the beautiful young Ruth on his arm. But there is a cloud overhead, and that is this. We know from previous parts of this story that Ruth is barren. She cannot have children. 10 years she went unable to have children. So there are no kids in her future, or at least there doesn't seem to be. And in verse 1:4, in chapter 1, verse 4, we're told that she had been married 10 years and there were no children. So even now, the suspense is not over. And remember, I said the lesson of the book of Ruth is that the life of someone pursuing God is not a straight line to glory. Life is one curve after another. We never know what's coming. But the point of the story is that the best is yet to come. No matter where you are, if you love God, the best is yet to come. And we'll see that as we arrive at the end of this story of Ruth. And the next question I want us to answer is this one this morning. Why is the focus on Naomi here? Because if you read this story, you'll see something unique is that the book is called Ruth, and yet it keeps coming back to Naomi. It keeps returning to her story. The dark cloud over the head of Boaz and Ruth dissolves in verse 13, and everything changes. Shortly after they're married, God blesses them with a son. She's no longer childless. One of the greatest curses that a woman of this time in history could face was broken. And notice how the focus then in verses 14 through 17 is not on Ruth at all. It's not on Boaz. It's not on the child even. It's on Naomi. Why? At the end of chapter 1, I referenced this earlier, Naomi was crying out in anguish because her life was ruined. She gives this whole thing of lament because her life is empty and void and she has nothing. She even went so far as to rename herself. She says, "Do not call me Naomi anymore. That's not my name. Call me Mara." And Mara means bitterness. That's what she said. She says, "Don't call me by my name anymore. Just call me Bitter Woman. That's how I want to be known for the rest of my life. Call me Bitter Woman." Maybe some of you have known that woman, but you don't call them that. Okay? But she actually says, "This is my new name." And that's the way the author of this book wanted us to meet her, as this woman who was destitute. She was broken. She had nothing left. Everything was gone. Because the theme of this book is that the life of someone following God is not a straight line to glory, but they do get there. And the story began with Naomi's loss, and it ends with Naomi's gain. It began with death and ends with birth. It ends with a son for whom, verse 17, is the great destination of Naomi's long and twisted road. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." Not to Ruth. They said, "A son has been born to Naomi." And I want to know, was Naomi in labor? No, Ruth was in labor. Okay? And yet they said, "A son has been born to Naomi," because children belong to the family in Hebrew culture. They didn't belong to Ruth. They belong to the family. And so Naomi now has this child that is her descendant, that is her inheritance, that is going to carry on what God has done through her. And they say it, they stress that to Naomi, not to Ruth. Why? To show that what Naomi said earlier in chapter 1 is not true. When Naomi had said in chapter 1 the Lord had brought her back empty from Moab, it was not true. And there's something we can learn here. I think sometimes we are too quick to blame God when things go badly in our lives. People are too quick to blame God. When things go great, sure, we'll take the credit. But when things go bad, too many people, even Christians, wonder, "Where is God? Why did he let this happen to me?" Maybe you've been there. Maybe most of us have been there. And here's the thing. God is a big God. He's got big shoulders. He can handle your complaining. He can handle the blame, even if it's not deserved. Because God did not abandon Naomi. No, not for a minute was she forsaken. God didn't forget about her. God was shaping her. God was using her story to shape your story, to shape my story. We read this now thousands of years later and we look back and the example of Naomi holds true in our lives today. What Ruth decided then now plays out in our lives today. We see them as an example of faith. And if we could just learn to wait and trust in God, all our complaints about God would prove to be untrue if we will stay the course. Proverbs 3:5 tells us, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not depend on your own understanding. Why? Because our understanding is limited. Our understanding is based on what we see right in front of us, on what is happening around us. God's understanding is based on eternity. So again and again in this book, it was God who was at work in the bitter setbacks of Naomi's life. When she lost her husband and sons, God gave her Ruth. When she could think of no kinsman to raise up offspring for the family name, God gave her Boaz. When barren Ruth married Boaz, God gave them a child. The point of the story is made in the life of Naomi. The life of someone following God is not a straight line to glory, but God sees that they get there. And as the worship team comes back up this morning, I want us to answer one final question, and that is this. Is glory too strong a word here for me to be using in this story? I mean, I said the theme is the road to glory, and maybe you think the word glory is a little over the top here. After all, we're just talking about her having a kid. It's not like, I mean, kids are great. I have 7, so obviously I think kids are pretty spectacular. But a grandmother holding a little child after a hard life filled with a ton of heartache, touching, sure, but is that really glory? Here's the thing. That's not the end of the story that Naomi got a grandkid. If this story of Ruth just ended in a little Judean village with an old grandmother hugging a new grandson, glory would be too big of a word. Yeah, it might be a happy ending, but it's certainly not glory. But the author doesn't leave it there. You've heard the expression, you can't see the forest through the trees. The saying means that because you only focus on what is right in front of you, you miss the bigger picture. All you're seeing is what's here right now, and you're missing the broader picture. And the author of Ruth looks past the trees of Naomi's life and sees the forest of redemptive history. In verse 17, the author says very simply that this child, Obed, was the father of Jesse, and Jesse was the father of David. All of a sudden, we realize that all along, something far greater would result from this story than we could possibly imagine. God was not only planning for the immediate blessing of a few Jews in Bethlehem, he was preparing for the coming of the greatest king that Israel would have, David. And the name of David carries with it the hope of the Messiah and peace and righteousness and freedom from pain and crying and grief and guilt. What begins as a simple little story opens wide into the greatest story ever told. And you may be going through a rough season right now, but you don't know what lies around that next corner. You don't know what's waiting for you, what blessing God has for you, what blessing he wants to bring through you. You don't know what greater narrative you're a part of that your story is going to help bring into existence. Your strong-willed, hard-to-handle son or daughter could grow up to be the next Billy Graham and lead our nation into the next season of revival. The struggles you're going through right now could be preparing you to help someone who would have no one else to turn to. And maybe they will end up being someone who changes the world for the cause of Christ. We see with our own understanding, but we need to trust in the Lord with all of our heart and where he's leading and how he's leading. The book of Ruth wants to teach us that God's purpose for the life of his people is to connect us to something far greater than ourselves. God wants us to know that when we follow him, our lives always mean more than we think they do. When we follow Jesus, our lives always mean more than we think they do. You are part of something bigger than you. For the Christian, there is always a connection between the ordinary events of life and the supernatural working of God in history. Everything we do in obedience to God, no matter how small, is significant. When you set up chairs at church, it's significant. When you pray for someone at your neighborhood group during the week, it's significant. When you bring a meal to a family who is struggling, it's significant. When you faithfully give to support what God is doing at Trilogy, it's significant. When you honor your atheist boss at work and do your best to make her look good, it's significant. It's part of this cosmic mosaic that God is painting to display his greatness and power and wisdom to the world. And what you're going through, what you're wrestling with right now, is part of that. God sees, God knows, God is here, and not for a minute are you forsaken? The deep satisfaction of a life following Jesus is that it's not filled with trivial things. Serving a widowed mother-in-law, gathering wheat in a field, falling in love, having a baby, everything that happened in the story of Ruth. For those following after God, for us as followers of Jesus, these things are all connected to eternity. They're not trivial in any way. They're a part of something so much bigger than they seem. So the word glory is not too strong. The life of those following God is not a straight line to glory, but they do get there because God sees to it. There is a hope for us beyond the cute baby and the happy grandmother in this story. If there weren't, most of this would be pointless. The story points forward to David. David points forward to Jesus. And Jesus points to our salvation and our eternal life. The life that Jesus won for us at the cross. In Revelation 21 describes for us where he says he will wipe every tear from their eyes and there will be no more death or sorrow or crying or pain. All these things are gone forever. I want you to understand that the story of Naomi and Ruth and Boaz and this baby that came out of that redeemed marriage leads straight to that moment in Revelation chapter 21. You don't know how God is working, but I want you to understand this. You can stand on this statement. You can live this. The best is yet to come. That is the unshakable truth about the life of the woman and the man who followed Jesus in the obedience of faith. It was true for Naomi, it was true for Ruth, and it's true for you. The best is yet to come. Would you bow your heads with me this morning?